'Tis now the very witching time of night when churchyards yawn and hell itself breathes out contagion to this world. Now could I drink hot blood?
I'd rather a Chardonnay myself, but if it's hot blood you're looking for this evening, you got it in spades here. I mean, that's hot-blooded music, isn't it?
But I was just thinking there, Tomás, even as I came in, you know, Hamlet's Fantasy and the overture from Tchaikovsky there, there's this common misconception, I think, about studying the great works in school, Hamlet or some of the great novels and something like that, you know, it's a guarantee to put you off for life. I have to say that's a slack opinion in my view. I did Hamlet in school, and I've had a lifelong love of it ever since. It was absolutely fantastic. Well taught, it's magnificent. Learned passages from it, went to see many, many productions, and got to know the play very well. But not well enough, I should tell you, because back in 1990 in Japan, I went to a kabuki theatre production of Hamlet, you know?
Kabuki.
Now, it's very stylized, and the costumes and everything are really central to it. And you might even get an actor there who'd be wearing a great big sort of an over costume, and two flunkies come out, and he stands still and takes this costume off him. And I hadn't the faintest notion what was going on. And I thought I knew that play.
Well, it's like, I mean, when I know that, I know it relatively well myself, and I sat there through the whole of the fantasy there going, which bit are we looking at now? I mean, you're just, you know, I'm trying to follow, and you're placing bits into it, and it's a bit hard, really.
Yeah.
I think, again, of course, it's another overture, so it's an evocative piece, as we say, so you can't pin any particular bit on it. But on the other hand, I was trying to think, is that my aural impression of Hamlet? Is it yours? Did you feel... I felt it was light.
I wonder if, for just the purposes of this evening, the name was changed or something. If you just didn't have that Hamlet... I think that Hamlet is interposing something between me, certainly, and trying to appreciate the music. I carry baggage in there, which, if I just heard it off one off for the first time ever, no one ever told me what it was, I think I might appreciate it more. But I failed to engage with it there. And I'm not criticising the performance at all. It's just the piece of music, because of what it's called... I can't really put words on what I was expecting, but I certainly failed to engage. I felt there was a block, something interposed between me and it, you know?
Yes, I mean, I suppose I did Coriolanus, so I think if it had had the word Coriolanus in front of it, well, I'd have probably run the other direction. I didn't have quite the you know, fantastic experience you have with Hamlet. And I felt certainly that put me off Coriolanus for the rest of my life.
So you had the opposite experience.
I had the opposite experience of it. But it's, you know, again, Hamlet is such a part of the culture that it's one of those ones where if you are going to do it, you've got to know that absolutely everybody knows every little bit of it. And it's one of the things that practically everybody who has studied literature or English or Russian will understand, and they know what you're saying. So it's a shorthand for saying, I'm about to express these particular views. So what are those particular views? Brooding self investigation, the idea of, you know, questioning your existence, existential angst, relationship to parents, relationship to siblings. Now, all of that, I'm trying to hear that in amongst this, you know, much more melodious, much smoother expression, musical expression, than I would expect to have heard. Now, naturally, I went off, as we all do now these days, looking, and the internet, such a great resource, and checking out Shostakovich. Of course, it says the theme tonight is, you know, Hamlet. And I thought, at first glance, perhaps everybody's Hamlet, but apparently not. Shostakovich did a Hamlet, of course. He did a Macbeth too, Lady Macbeth of the Medinsk district. But he certainly did a Hamlet too. And his is more brooding. I thought his was a more existential aural experience. I could hear my views on Hamlet in Shostakovich better than I could in Tchaikovsky. But maybe he's a 20th century existentialist. He's got all of that, you know, he has that engagement, the personal engagement with it now. Whereas you've got Tchaikovsky. This is when Tchaikovsky's beginning to creak a little. You know, he's off in the distance from us. He's a little remote into the 19th century experience, whereas Shostakovich is right there. Couple of world wars, angst, revolution, the rise of the individual, the rise of the proletariat, much more, you know, what I felt I was looking for myself in this. It was ambitious programming tonight, for sure. They've gone for the other ones, but I think they might have missed a trick by not putting another Hamlet, the Shostakovich Hamlet in here as well.
Interesting you should mention the programming, Tomas. I think you're right in saying it's interesting, and I'm glad to see it, because if you think about it, Tchaikovsky, best known for the ballet music, they're not playing that tonight. Shostakovich, best known for his symphonies, they're not playing that tonight. Rachmaninoff, best known for his piano concerto, not playing that tonight. I think it's good that they've gone ahead and done that. Slightly brave, you might say. They've got three very well-known names, but they're perhaps just going just slightly off the beaten track, not plowing the same old furrow all the time. We mentioned there about, moving on. That Shostakovich. And the great thing about it was, I love tracking back through the generations and the decades and saying, tonight's performer, for instance, Ivan Monaghetti, he was Rostropovich's final pupil. Shostakovich wrote the concerto for Rostropovich, who learnt it in 4 days and performed it for the first time in 1959, I think. So if any performer is well qualified to play it and well qualified to interpret it, and we've talked about the whole idea of interpretive art, I know if anybody is qualified to do it, it's this man here tonight. And it's a very challenging piece. Remarkably challenging piece. There's periods in it when, the soloist is, I was going to say, is playing as a soloist, self-evident, but it's almost as there are passages of minutes long of solo playing with the orchestra almost forming a second audience behind the performer. It's a remarkable piece of work, absolutely fantastic.
Obviously, previously we've been able to listen to the music, and I think Rostropovich was the first person to, he had the first recording of it himself, and that was with Eugene Normandy, I think, and that performance of it, it was frozen in time, and that's the classical performance, and you hear that. But then you can go back to the net and you can find video of Rostropovich performing it. So not only do we now have that experience of being able to listen to the perfected, recorded performance, we can now see a live performance. And my goodness, I think you probably saw it yourself. There's something to live up to for tonight. But I think very well done.
Oh, I think so. Yes, unquestionably. I loved looking back at some of those. I almost call them slightly antique black and white filming and performance. Much fewer cameras, much less fancy camera work and so forth. And, we can tend to get dazzled by today's ability to put tiny cameras in between the musicians and everything. I actually quite like that sort of more stilted, almost starchy way of showing it, almost, because you can really concentrate in on the music rather than saying, oh my god, that's a fantastic angle, how did they get that, is that interfering with the musician's ability to play, blah de blah. But that performance, obviously I watched the same one as you did, remarkable stuff.
I couldn't agree more. I think it's very interesting in that it's like looking back at George Best. You're seeing the thing from a distance, so you can see a run. And when you're looking at Pelé, you're looking at a whole run from the half to the actual goal, and you get a sense not of being cut up to give us the flashy angles of his speed, but you actually get a complete honest sense of speed by seeing these older single camera kind of tracking events. So there's a little similarity in it as well. But another thing that's hitting me all the time when I'm watching music, which is now a phenomenon for me for the last 3 or 4 years, is that I've stopped becoming obsessed with the audio perfection that I was looking for. I was one of those people who, buying records, you're looking for a record that was AAD, audio, then digital. And then there was an ADD, and then I had to have those ones. Yeah. And then finally they were CDs, which were DDD, and I thought, oh, my God, it couldn't get any better than this.
I DDD. Remember, yeah, you'd look for DDD.
DDD.
Yeah. It's like buying a bra.
Not something I've done myself, Raven. So we've got that to that peak of DDD and with the CDs, but now I'm watching music, I'm not interested at all. I'm so focused and seeing the way in which the performer is performing, and exactly as you're saying with the Rostropovich piece, where you're looking at the rest of the orchestra become an audience. You're watching all that, which is the brilliance of the live performance, the brilliance of coming here tonight, where we get to see the performers, and you can look back at somebody in the third row. And you choose what you're going to look at.
Absolutely. That's something I've often thought about. I find myself, if I'm at a live, it doesn't have to be a concert, but any live event, I find myself, my eye wandering to a place where I'm fairly certain the camera won't be. And I want to say, so somebody is playing away so furiously up the front. I was like, what's that guy doing down the back, you know? And similarly on the sports field, you know, I know the camera will be, you know, focusing on the line out. So I look over, so what's that winger doing over there in the far wing? You know, is he paying attention? I find that fascinating. And certainly in the musical sense, it's really instructive to see that happening, because we do get a much more stilted, you might say, manufactured view on the television, no matter how well it's produced. So I think it's useful to get that here. So what about Shostakovich, Tomas?
I think, you know, are we looking at the greatest symphonic producer of the 20th century?
I think very possibly so, yes. But I find myself approaching his music in the same way as I do with Wagner. Now, let me explain, because I don't see similarities.
Okay, yes, okay, you'll have to explain this one.
Have another drink. And, if you think about it, Tomas, it's almost impossible to consider Wagner's operas without the whole issue of anti-Semitism raising its head, which is something we touched on there a few weeks ago, the whole idea of the whole anti-Semitism and the ugliness there, and yet the beauty of his music. I find a similar challenge, I won't say call it a problem, with music of Shostakovich, where it's very hard to look at his music without knowing the backstory. I mean, he was a man who, you know, suffered denunciation and repression, all sorts of the massive state machinery weighing on his shoulders the whole time. I mean, the line of introduction to the Fifth Symphony, for instance, was something to the effect of, you know, an artist responds to just criticism. It was almost like a show trial type of thing, you know? And, of course, the Fifth Symphony was remarkably popular, and yet at the same time, if you listen to it very carefully, what had he managed to somehow very subtly camouflage what he was really saying? Certainly at the end of the Fifth Symphony, you get this terrible pounding sound coming through, and I think he himself even said that it was like, you know, being beaten down the whole time. And coming back to most of what we said about the whole idea of interpretive art, I was very lucky a few years ago. I went to see a performance of the Fifth Symphony with the LSO in the Barbican, and my old pal Gergiev was conducting. So in the advance, in the week leading up to that, I listened to recordings five times. I listened to it five times. And on the night, it was like listening to a new piece of music, a fresh piece of music, and that was a one-off. I will never hear that again. We'll never pass this way again. I'll never hear that again. And that really rammed home to me the whole idea of the interpretation on the night for a performance, which I thought was fantastic. But I'm drifting.
Again, I'm trying to find performances by Shostakovich during his lifetime in the Soviet era. So that's my current little net project, is to actually find this. Because I want to see how the orchestra perform in these circumstances. And when I was listening now, even just to the cello, concerto now, when you're looking at that, you're thinking, how was that performed in the Soviet? I mean, the recordings we have are when Rostropovich comes to America, but I want to see how it was done. The complexity of this, and I think you've said this yourself, the complexity of Shostakovich's later works may be a way of burying and disguising his hatred for the regime. If you make it complicated enough, they won't see what I'm really talking about. So how were they performing? Were they performing it when we get these dry, sort of plucked elements within the concerto now? We see it as naked and open. Was it buried? You know, was that seen as just very calm? We now see that as it's critical.
Ladies and gentlemen, our doors will close in 5 minutes. We request that you take your seats in the auditorium. Our doors will close in 5 minutes.
But I think, you know, he is a great composer because partly there was such funding for his oeuvre. One of the problems with anyone wanting to compose symphonies is there has to be a little cash behind this whole event. Symphonies are expensive things to produce, to put on, and to begin to think about composing and so forth. Now, in the past, you had great patrons, you had the church as a huge, sort of orthodoxy, with a great deal of money and able to help these productions. So you had this, you had a high watermark previously. The 20th century is Russia's peak moment in symphonic production, partly because of the massive orthodoxy of the Soviet Union was able to fund someone like Shostakovich to go on and on and on producing 10 and on symphonies and stage them. You look back at... it's very hard to see that happening anywhere else, except, of course, when you finally get money streaming out of Hollywood. And Hollywood becomes the West's, you know, sort of a great patron. And I think that's, again, something we see now consistently on the circuit, on the concert circuit, is that, and I think we're going to see it in a couple of weeks' time, great music is being produced for the films, you know, for the movies. And that's largely because there's the money for it.
Is that a VAT you're drinking, Tomás?
It is, but it's a Thursday night, so I'm just on the one now.
Remember Arthur Daly?
Vodka and tonic.
And you know, if you wanted to, you could have a Rachmaninoff vodka. Can you imagine? You know, you were always going on with postage stamps and coins and banknotes and God knows what else. There's a German vodka called Rachmaninoff.
I think we'd better avoid it because it's a Thursday night. I mean, the other thing is, I have to render my objection that we have to be swung into the middle of the week because lovers are required to be here for Friday night.
Will you not be here strewing rose petals around tomorrow night?
I shall be strewing rose petals elsewhere.
Did I ever tell you how I met Rachmaninoff? Well, not quite met, Tomás, but how I came to know him. I was about 15 years of age. I remember my mother was always talking about the Piano Concerto No. 2, which is easily his best-known piece, very lyrical, romantic piece. So one year for Christmas, I bought a recording of it with Sviatoslav Richter on the piano. Magnificent. I was absolutely hooked. I don't think she ever got a chance to play it. I was playing it so much, but she did get at least a chance to listen to it, you know? But we're not. We have a symphony now from Rachmaninoff, which got off to a very shaky start, I believe.
Hugely shaky. I mean, but again, the problem here is we're talking about Russia as the great home of the symphony, and what we have here is a failed symphony that was then lost, then reconstructed. And I often feel about this. I think, you know, this, the first symphony here by Rachmaninoff is one of these ones where I'm a little concerned about its provenance. You know, it's reconstructed from 12 different parts by 9 people over a lengthy period of time after it's rediscovered in a drawer in 1944 after he's dead. If you brought that in to try and sell it in Sotheby's, they'd throw you out the door.
Like the Hitler Diaries.
Like the Hitler Diaries or a Chagall found it.
Yeah, the one that's going to be burnt.
Yes, just like this. So, they might not burn this, but, you know, you'd have to be worried. You'd have to have 5 people come in and tell me this is pure Rachmaninoff. None of it seems disastrously poor, but on the other hand, none of it seems symphonically engaging either.
The original performance was conducted, the premiere was conducted by Glazunov, this chap with a fantastic musical reputation, though not as a conductor. It was even suggested he was drunk on the podium at the time. And
another beauty of a live performance. Yes.
exactly, interpretive. But it seems, I mean, the suggestions, anything I've heard, is that he ruined it. That it was the conductor and the performance, rather than the music they were performing, that was ruined. And it was absolutely slated. It nearly, well, I wouldn't say killed Rachmaninoff, but for 3 years afterwards, he didn't touch a thing in terms of composing. He was in a deep depression. He needed all sorts of therapy to get him out of it. And finally, what did come out of it was the Piano Concerto. So perhaps something good did come out of it. But really, he suffered terribly as a consequence of that premiere.
I'm just thinking, when we hear this now performed, it's decadent. It's self-interested. It is a self-aware, self-investigating, self-reflective, you know, bourgeois, narcissistic symphony to me. And maybe that's Hamlet. Maybe that's somebody's view of Hamlet.
Ooh, we've got back to Hamlet by a roundabout route, shall we say. But it was an extraordinary career that Rachmaninoff had, because he had one foot really in each camp of composer and performer. And it almost divided half and half, because once he left what was to become the Soviet Union in, what was it, 1917 or 18?
Oh, he scarpered early.
He scarpered early, but he really felt he had to. And he made his life then in the United States. And it was pretty tough going initially. He had to master the piano repertoire at the time. He, you know, these performers have a big repertoire they've mastered. He was in his 40s at this stage, had to do that. But apparently he was one of the greatest pianists ever, one of the greatest performers in that sense. But of course his composing took a hit as a consequence of that. And he did lots of recording. He really forged a completely separate, different career. But apparently he was constantly homesick for Russia. He never really recovered from leaving home like that. But I think it's it gave him a unique insight. He even said himself, being a composer and a performer, gave him an insight into how to perform and how to interpret the works. And he always spoke about wanting to put colour, to put some colour, to put some gloss onto it. And I remember once hearing a violist, a famous Italian violist, Bruno Giurano is his name, very, very well regarded. And I remember hearing him in a rehearsal with a string quartet and talking, and he said, we've got to look behind the notes. It's no use just, a student could play that, but we've got to look behind the notes. What's the message behind the notes? And I can't help feeling that Rachmaninoff, because of his experience as a composer, was able to see behind the notes. No matter what he was playing.
Ladies and gentlemen, all doors are now closing. We request that you take your seats in the auditorium immediately. All doors are now closing. Thank you.